This is Lifemint.com and you're listening to the Editor's Podcast with Ajay Vaishnav and Mint Editor R. Sukumar.
Most happening topic is India-China standoff. And there have been several developments from Chinese media taking an aggressive stand and suggesting that New Delhi should be taught a bitter lesson from today Modi complimenting Xi Jinping for all developments that is taking place in BRICS. And in turn, President Xi complimented Modi for his resolve to fight terrorism. So what should we make out of it?
I think let's start with what's happened today, which is the mutual exchange of compliments. I think this is part of the diplomatic effort by both countries to sort of smoothen things out. But let's go back and look at what's happening in Doklam. I think this is the first time in a long while that India has acted very firmly with China. In this case, of course, there's a third party involved, which is Bhutan, whose territory is what the Chinese have gotten into. And India has an agreement with Bhutan under which it is beholden to take the side of Bhutan. India was also worried about growing Chinese presence in that region because it comes very close to the so-called chicken neck, which is the link between Indian vast parts of India and the northeastern states of India. And I think the Chinese were probably a little bit surprised by the resolve that India has shown in this, because India's approach has been not overtly aggressive, but not passive either, right? I mean, there's been a certain bit of aggression shown, certain bit of force that has been shown in the sheer presence of India in that region. And I think China is not used to that kind of resolve from India. It's, of course, extremely critical that India not back off from this position, right? Because you can't allow China to open a new front. You already have disputes with them in the northeastern parts, in Arunachal Pradesh, for instance. It makes no sense to open up a new front with them. So I think this is something that needs to be extinguished right now. But now that the aggression has been shown, I think everyone was very clear that it was time for some smooth and smart diplomatic maneuvering. And I think the conversation that's happened today, not the conversation because they didn't meet, but the exchange of compliments that has happened today is part of that diplomatic effort. I think neither country wants this to degenerate into an armed conflict, however small it might be, because that doesn't work to the advantage of either country. But I think it was very important in India's case to show that it was taking a stand, and it succeeded in doing that.
And India's response has been very balanced. We have not made any aggressive statements compared to what Chinese state media has been saying, especially about that whole point that we should teach New Delhi a bitter lesson.
That's true. I think, of course, there's also been some irresponsible Indian media which has practically declared war on China. But your point is well made, because in China's case, this is state media, which is pretty much the voice of the state which is saying these things. But I think that's par for the course, right? Like I said previously, I think the Chinese were a little taken aback by the resolve that India has shown so far, which is why it made it all the more critical that India not back down from its position. But equally important is the fact that this resolve that was shown be backed up by some very, very smart diplomatic moves. And I think you will see that come into play now.
Other thing which has been dominating the headlines is Modi's Israel visit. I think he has charmed his way in Israel. But what everyone has been pointing is that he has skipped Palestine. Being the first prime minister to visit Israel, he should have gone there. Many experts and many people are saying. And we still support Palestinian cause. We still believe in two-state theory. We believe that there should be a Palestinian state which should live peacefully with Israel. But not going there, does it mean fundamentally our foreign policy stance on that issue has changed? And mind you, in the last 2 years, we have abstained on UN resolutions which criticized Israel's human rights records.
Okay, I think this is one of those cases where you have the past and you have a legacy foreign policy, which for a long time was very, very anti-Israel and very pro-Palestine, to an evolving consensus, which also has to be seen in the larger context of India's growing closeness to the United States, which is Israel's biggest ally, as well as the need for India to partner with Israel on a variety of areas, including anti-terrorism, including arms, because India does need arms equipment, and Israel is a huge supplier to global markets. It's an extremely technologically advanced nation, has got a huge startup culture, huge IT culture, has a tremendously vibrant pharmaceutical industry, has succeeded in very efficient use of technology to boost agricultural productivity, even in areas where there is very little water. Israel is a world leader in desalination. So the list is endless, right? So it's one of those things where I think we let our legacy foreign policy prevent us from becoming closer to a country which could have helped us in a lot of areas. Mm-hmm. And I think that is the gap that has been addressed now. As far as Palestine is concerned, Palestine's Prime Minister was just here the President of Palestine was just here a month and a half back, and we received him. Yeah. Modi met with him. So it's not as if we've cut off our ties with Palestine. That relationship is going along. But just because you're friendly with one country doesn't mean you should not be friendly with a country which is not particularly friendly with that first country, right? I mean, the transitive property works in mathematics. I don't think it works in diplomacy. So I think what Modi has done is a fairly smart thing. Sure, I mean, people can always say, why could he not stop by Palestine? But you should also look at the agenda of the Prime Minister. He's been traveling extensively. He was in the United States, then Israel, India, then Israel. And now from there, he had to go to Hamburg for G20. Could he have squeezed in some time in Palestine? Maybe. But then, you know, he's just met the President of Palestine. So why would he want to go there again and do this? I think it was very important for India to send out this message that we want a good relationship, a mutually beneficial relationship with Israel. And as far as Israel is concerned, you saw the welcome that he got there. I think they are thrilled. And my own sense is this country will go all out to help India in a variety of areas. So I think it's been a successful visit.
So two issues, and it looks like that Modi's foreign policy is going well.
Yes, on the basis of a particularly successful visit to the United States. And please remember that this was a visit where nothing much was expected, right? But it was still showed that the US and India were willing to carry on from where the previous regime in the US had left off. And then you have Israel, you have the fact that India has actually not backed down from this confrontation with China and is now behaving like a mature country and trying to take the diplomatic way to solve things. I think so far, over the last 3 weeks at least, I don't think India has put a foot wrong when it comes to its foreign policy.
Staying on the foreign policy stuff, Trump and Putin are expected to meet at the G20 summit. And this has come a day before Trump said that Russia could have meddled in November last year's presidential elections. Do you see any rapprochement between the two, or and whether it will benefit global agenda, global commons issues?
See, Trump and Putin are actually close to each other, right? I mean, they have a particularly bad relationship with each other. If you were to ask the Russians who they would like to see in the White House, they probably can have no better person in the White House. I think the bigger story in G20 is really not so much about diplomacy or any of these other things. I think the two big issues are issues that are core to our newsroom, which is a business newsroom, which is really trade and which is climate. And in both cases, the interesting thing is the United States is actually in the minority because it is against multilateralism or what the WTO stands for. And so it's been isolated on that front. And on climate, again, it's trying to tread its own thing. So it will be interesting to see what kind of resolution G20 puts out, what kind of statement G20 puts out at the end of it all, because I think that would be interesting to see from the perspective of trade and from the perspective of climate. Everything else is pretty much a sideshow as far as the G20 is concerned.
Coming to India, it's been 1 week GST has been rolled out. And as our last discussion pointed out, that there will be initial hiccups, there will be some glitches. But 1 week, what is your assessment?
It's not gone badly, right? I mean, sure, there are glitches here and there. There have had to be clarifications, but it's not gone badly. I know this might sound facetious, but the interesting thing is GST has actually taken a tax, with basically indirect tax, which all of us have paid all our lives, right? I mean, if you went out and bought a packet of biscuits 15 years ago, you were paying indirect tax. Yeah. And Indians are very comfortable paying indirect tax. It's only when it comes to paying direct tax, which is income tax, that they have all sorts of issues. Yeah. So everyone pays indirect tax, and we don't even recognize recognize it. It's an invisible tax. I think GST's big success is in taking this invisible tax and making it this very, very pop kind of phenomenon. Because on the day it was launched and over the last week, you've seen countless people on social media take photographs of their bills and showcase it, saying, look at it, bill with GST and things like that. So it's become mainstream. But the fact is, those bills are being generated. Sure, there are some small traders who are yet to upgrade their billing systems and their filing systems, and they will be there. The first filing under GST doesn't need to happen till late August or early September, which is when, if there are any real glitches in the system, you will probably get to know that. Mm-hmm. But right now, it's just everyone has to charge. People are charging. Everyone has to produce bills. They're producing bills. There needs to be some clarity. We ourselves have pointed out lots of little issues. For instance, liquor in the short term may get cheaper, but in the long term may get more expensive when you drink out, just like you eat out. There are some retailers still who are confused, and as a result, their consumers are probably not paying the right price, and those things have to be sorted out. There was some confusion over the maximum retail price of the display of the maximum retail price of products that were already there in the pipeline, and the government clarified that you could use a sticker. Companies then went out and pointed out that the use of stickers was illegal under another government rule. So that rule has now been, the notification has now happened under that regime to say that, sure, you can go ahead and use the sticker. So I think, by and large, my sense is clarity is emerging. There is disruption, but it is clearly temporary. It's not as bad as some people were expecting it to be. I mean, of everything coming to a halt. At some level, there was some destocking that happened at the retailer level. Exactly. There was some hoarding that happened at the consumer level. I know of people in our newsroom who hoarded a little bit of stuff. And I think many of these fears have been unfounded. So the first week has been good. It's actually been pretty good.
In fact, consumers are having good time. Car prices have come down.
The car prices are significantly down.
I know that many companies were offering discounts, pre-GST discount.
Yeah.
But after that, the discount is, the prices which have come down is actually higher than what they were offering.
Correct. I mean, there are several categories where the prices have come down. Sure, in some cases, service tax is considered from 15, it's gone up to 18%. Yeah. But that's been a little bit of an increase. But by and large, it's been disruption-free. And I think that's extremely significant for the first week for such a big change.
Last, we should also discuss Air India privatization. And IndiGo has shown interest in it. They want to use Air India's infrastructure and staff manpower for their long haul.
Yesterday, they had a conference. And I think, to me, they had an analyst call. And to me, the interesting thing in that analyst call was the fact that they clearly said they want to launch low-cost long-haul or low-cost international operations because they see that there is an opportunity in that market. Two, that they will do this with or without Air India. The third thing they said, again very critical, was they are more interested in the international operations of Air India and the low-cost domestic operations rather than everything else. Four, they want a complete divestment. They do not want to have a situation where the government is even a minority partner in the airline. But at the same time, if you listen to the analyst call, and I did, and they did spend some time looking at the significant advantages that anyone getting Air India would end up with. One is, of course, the fleet strength, but they also mentioned the bilaterals that Air India has with various countries. They mentioned the fact that Air India has got prized slots in many of the most crowded airports. Almost impossible to get today, but because Air India has been in existence since the mid-50s, fairly easy for Air India to get this. Or Air India has been in existence for 70 years, right? I mean, so I think it's interesting that there's so much interest in the privatization of Air India and the divestment of Air India by the government. Still a long haul. In yesterday's analyst call, when one of the analysts asked the IndiGo promoters how much time they thought it would take, their answer was a year. My own sense is that this is a very aggressive timeline because all we have so far is a clearance from the Union Cabinet. And you have everything else that's got to happen now. You'll have to figure out what to do with Air India's employees. They have around 7 unions. So what are you going to do with the employees? You'll have to figure out what you're going to do with the real estate. Are you going to spin it off into a separate company? Then you'll have to get into this complex issue of what are you going to do with the debt? And then how is the valuation of Air India going to be worked out? So it's a long-drawn process. But the fact that IndiGo explained the logic and everything else seems to indicate to me that there will be more people who are interested in Air India over a period of time. You haven't had anyone else come out in public and say they are interested, but I'm sure that will happen as and when more details about the divestment become clear.
Do let us know what you think. You can email us at feedback@livemint.com or follow us at Livemint on Twitter and Mint on Facebook.